Second matter on the 9 o'clock docket is Carvajal against State Farm. And counsel, you may set up when your tables are free. And Mr. Haywood, you may proceed when you are ready.
Please the court. Good morning. My name is Drew Haywood. I'm counsel for the plaintiff, Leticia Carvajal, in this matter. It is silly that we have a specific piece of property that is uniquely situated to this specific defendant and this specific plaintiff. And the trial court has said that the only method of having access to that piece of property is via personal service.
Counsel, I understand that your position is that you disagree with that ruling, but in light of the absence of any case that directly addresses this issue other than Sinan, don't you think that saying that it is silly is putting it a little harshly?
I don't think so, because we have specifically created quasi and rim jurisdiction, which is particularly applicable in this situation. And the Sinan case, it says that without a judgment against the defendant, that there should be no method of collection. But there's no case that says that that is the only method by which the indemnity portion of the policy can be accessed.
Mr. Haywood, as I understand quasi and rem jurisdiction, the perfect example of it is when there is a ship full of materials docked, and the lawsuit is brought against someone who is absent, but the ship and the materials belong to that person or entity. And the jurisdiction can be asserted against that person to the limit of the value of the property. In this case, you've got a contingent liability contract.
You do have a contingent liability, but it's been determined that that is nonetheless a cognizable property interest for the purposes of quasi and rim jurisdiction. And that's what the Baker case tells us.
But you can't, does Baker say that you don't have to test the liability of the defendant before and until you can look to the value of the property of a contingent contract?
Baker expressly made a holding that they were not going to make a determination as to that issue. And what the defendant has done is cited Sinan, which says that absent a judgment against the defendant, that you can't access the policy. And what the plaintiff is saying in this case is that this situation is similar and that this is a property interest, and that it is recognized as a property interest under the law and under Baker. And the plaintiff, much like in the situation that you give with the ship that's docked, should have access to that property. And the holding in Sinan, the plaintiff's position is that the holding in Sinan does not preclude the plaintiff from getting access to that property from a determination of the plaintiff's rights in that piece of property.
Just as a practical matter, let's take the ship example. The law can expect that the owner of the ship is going to be observant and diligent about watching out for it. So the very concept of attaching it and asserting jurisdiction on the basis of it gives a pretty good chance of alerting the owner to the case. Where there is an automobile insurance policy, how does that assure that the owner of that policy or the insured is nevertheless going to find out about the lawsuit simply because the contract is attached?
Well, I don't think that that is necessary, and that's not what the law says. If you read the Mullane case, the United States Supreme Court case, yes, Mullane talks about the need that there's a recognition that you know, we won't notice reasonably, or we won't service to reasonably provide notice. But there's also a couple of statements in Mullane that recognize that there are certain situations whereby notice by publication may actually be futile. And they recognize that. And in fact, they say that there's this quote-unquote assumption that the property has even been abandoned. And that may be the case here with the insurance policy, but that's permitted by the law. And Mullane tells us that in certain circumstances, specifically in the cases of missing or unknown defendants, as the language in Mullane says, that service by publication is effective because we recognize the need for a party to be able to bring an action and have their day in court. And effectively what the district court did in this particular situation is they foreclosed the plaintiff from ever having a day in court.
But we also have the concept that we need to give notice to a defendant. In the Wild West, it was enough to tack a notice on a fence post of property owned by the defendant. But how does it calculate to give notice to the owner of an insurance policy to attach the policy?
Well, because the law specifically provides for that. Rule 4G of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure say that service by publication, if certain steps are followed, is effective. And the U.S. Supreme Court has held that's correct.
How would publication be calculated to get notice to a defendant if the defendant's not in the state of Colorado?
Well, that brings me to a good point. It seems like the intervener here has argued that the defendant's not in the state of Colorado. We don't know where the defendant is. The defendant is missing or unknown, I would classify. But if you look at the affidavit submitted and the steps that were taken to notify the defendant of the pendency of the action, we don't know where the defendant is. There's a last known address. That's the best we've got. And that situation is very distinct from the situation in Sinan. Sinan, which is the case that the intervener relies on, was a specific situation where there was a defendant that the plaintiff knew had moved to Japan to continue their studies there in Japan, yet published notice here in Colorado. This situation, in this case, is different because we have a defendant with a last known address. There were multiple attempts that were made to serve that defendant there with two different investigators. There were interviews conducted with neighbors. There were these post office box breakers that were, you know, it's an investigative technique that the investigators attempted. There's no evidence of the defendant, you know, anywhere, sort of the whole Kaiser Soze effect. But
So Mr. Haywood, if I may interrupt, please, we don't know where this defendant is. We have no clue where this defendant is.
That's correct.
And thus, theoretically, I'm not saying in fact, but theoretically, this defendant could be in Japan also. We don't know.
Could be, but that's a different situation than knowing that defendant is in Japan, and that's a different situation than what happened in Sinan. And the Supreme Court in Mullane has told us that this service by publication is an effective means of providing service.
Well, let's take a look back at Remine. Remine, as far as I can tell, is still the law in this state. And considering we begin with what Judge Graham asked you about, that this is a contingent claim, why doesn't Remine control here?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. And really, it gets to sort of two separate issues that are pulling on one another here. The first is the due process issue, and the second is the right to proceed against the policy. Remine says that quasi and rem jurisdiction cannot impose personal liability. And that's not what the plaintiff is seeking to do here. There are these statements in the intervener's briefs about imposing personal liability. That's not what the plaintiff wants to do. The plaintiff wants to attach the policy and move against the policy quasi and rem and seek a determination that here's the defendant's interest in that property by alleging facts that show the defendant's interest in the property. Allege facts that show here's my interest in that property as a plaintiff, this specific piece of property that is uniquely situated to this specific defendant, and therefore I should be allowed to receive that property up to the limits of the property. And that's different than a personal judgment that the plaintiff would seek against the defendant. And so Remind says that, that quasi and rem jurisdiction cannot impose personal liability, but that's not what the plaintiff is seeking to do here. The plaintiff is seeking to attach the property and proceed against it quasi and rem.
Can you point to a single case after Remind in which we have this insurance context that applies your theory?
Sure. Well, I...
A Colorado case that applies your theory.
It depends on when you're talking about apply the theory. If you're asking for a situation where there's been a determination that the plaintiff has a right to collect directly, quasi and rem, there are no situations. If you're asking for case law where the plaintiff is allowed to attach the policy and proceed, there's reams of cases.
Yeah,
Jewett, for example.
But why doesn't Rule 102 in this context basically allow you to go in and attach the policy pre-judgment? In other words, you've got that thing there so that you don't have to worry about it going anywhere. And then why doesn't, as sign-in indicate, before you can get to the money, say that you need to have a judgment against the insured?
Well, I think that's the gap. And I think that's the question that this court's got to resolve. There's an inherent tension in sign-in, for example, and then on the other hand, Baker and Jewett, because the facts in this case are almost exactly like Jewett, where we had a resident defendant that had gone missing, and the trial judge dismissed the case pre-judgment and said, sorry, you can't attach the policy because ultimately I don't think you can collect from it.
But again, Mr. Haywood, talking about Jewett, didn't the division there state that it was expressing no opinion whether plaintiff may enforce against the policy any judgment entered in the absence of proper service of process upon defendant?
That's correct. And that I would tender is the gap, the hole in where we are in the law right now. And perhaps it's an issue that the legislature should have addressed at some point, but unfortunately the legislature hasn't. And so it falls to us to determine what these things mean. When you look at Baker, the Supreme Court case, Baker specifically allows attachment. Now, my question is, why would Baker contemplate the attachment of the policy and allow allow that prejudgment attachment, allow you to proceed quasi and rem, but ultimately say, well, without a personal judgment, you can't get access to the proceeds of that policy? Because that the clear implication from both Baker and Jewett is that there has to be some means to receive this indemnity portion of the proceeds, although it's a contingent interest. And the plaintiff submits that that mechanism is quasi and rem jurisdiction, and that's why we have quasi and rem jurisdiction. And what happened in this case is that the trial court dismissed the action, assuming that the plaintiff could never receive any of the proceeds. And we've got cases specifically on point that say that's wrong. So at the very least, this case needs to be remanded on that basis. Jewett, this case is very similar to the Jewett case, and Baker. So we would also tender that to the extent that the issue of whether attachment tort actions are allowed is ripe for review, that quasi and rem jurisdiction is the mechanism by which we can collect from the policy. So I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay, Mr. Haywood, you've got 2 minutes and 28 seconds.
Thanks, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Henson. I represent the intervener State Farm in this matter.
Mr. Henson, let me ask, would it have made a difference here if the insurance contract had been a life insurance contract with a cash value?
I think it depends. If you're talking about a personal injury action, I think the same result would occur because Colorado law has set forth that personal injury actions are in personam actions. And so if this arises out of a personal injury, I think you reach the same result because it's in personam. And what we have here is a quasi and rem case. And the court in Remind, I think, stated that a personal injury case is a in personam case. And you can't turn a quasi and rem case into an in personam case. And that's, I believe, what's attempting to be done in this particular instance.
Even if you have a fund that is readily liquidated and available to a successful plaintiff?
Well, again, it requires that you have the in personam jurisdiction, and absent proper service, I believe you come up to the same situation you have in this particular instance. This case is very much on pretty much all squares with Sinan in terms of the issues of service as it relates to the issues of attachment of the policy and the quasi in rem jurisdiction and the in personam jurisdiction. It's a well-settled law in Colorado that an injured party can't bring a direct action against the alleged tortfeasor's insurer. That's essentially what's occurring in this particular instance through this quasi in rem case, and the Sinan court realized that. As it relates to the service, although as the intervener, we really didn't argue that the court sua sponte brought that up in its order of May 7th and 8th, or rather March 7th and 8th of 2008. It's not unlike the signing case where the court held that service of process for purposes of due process has to be something more than just a gesture. In that particular case, signing, there was some evidence that the alleged tortfeasor was living in Japan, yet there was no attempt to make service there. Everything indicated that they weren't in the area where, in fact, they did serve them. Very much similarly, in this particular instance, you have a case where the last known residence of the defendant was in Aurora, and the process servers, the investigator, all evidence suggested they were no longer living in Aurora, yet that's where they were served through publication in an online publication called the Aurora Sentinel. So the evidence suggests there wasn't any, the defendant, alleged tortfeasor, wasn't living there, yet that's where they made the publication, which, based upon Siren and Mullane, indicates that that would be improper service vis-a-vis publication, and nothing more than a mere gesture, and would not satisfy the requirements of due process.
Mr. Henson, let me come back and thank you for your answer to my question. I think you answered it, but I'm still struggling with this issue. Forget about publication for a moment. When we attach property, not contingent liabilities, but property of a potential defendant, aren't we pretty sure that a defendant's going to get notice of it? For example, with the life insurance policy with a substantial cash value, isn't that defendant who owns that policy going to find out about it getting attached and then have notice that there's a lawsuit pending that calls into question the liability of that potential defendant?
Perhaps.
Well, does the law require more than a calculated probability that the defendant's going to have notice when the process server has come back nulla bona nine times?
Well, I believe that the service of process has to be such that it's going to give, has some calculated ability to give notice to that particular alleged tortfeasor. And it's a case-by-case situation, and in this instance, and I know the court reviews this de novo, but the district court judge in this instance felt that this wasn't adequate notice based upon the facts of this particular case. As it relates to, you know, a life insurance policy, you know, perhaps, but I think it's a different situation than what we have here. Getting back to the issue, which I think is where the court really, district court, focused its attention, was that simply of this quasi in rem action, and since a personal injury case is an in personam action, that proceeding in a quasi in rem case will never get you where you have to go. I mean, if you look at this, there's a number of roadblocks. Colorado law would have to be overturned in a number of factors in terms of all around transportation, saying that you can't bring a direct action against the alleged tortfeasor's insurance company. Remind saying that personal injury action is in personam and not quasi in rem, and then sign in, which says that, you know, quasi in rem won't create personal jurisdiction, in which is really what you have to have based upon the contingent nature of the liability. Now, there's been discussion about, well, we're not wanting to proceed in personam, even though a personal injury action, just like this complaint was pled, was a personal injury action. We want to proceed against the policy and determine the value of this contingent liability. It's important to realize the Baker Court, which was required to answer this from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, a specific question, and they made it very clear that the only question they were answering as it relates to the question posed to them by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals is whether or not a liability insurance policy was non-exempt property properly attached under 4G. And that's the only thing they answered. And they made it very clear that we are not commenting on, you know, the value of that to the insured. Also, Sinan discusses the fact that there was a default judgment entered in that case. So there was a judgment, unlike in this case where they want to get a judgment. But even with the judgment being entered for the policy limits, the court said it's a contingent liability. There's no way to change this into an in personam case, which is where you have to go. So in essence, what you do is you proceed down this road, and it's an exercise in futility because you can never get to the step you need to get to in order to have personal jurisdiction. Thank you, Your Honors. Any other questions? I'd be happy to answer or attempt to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson. Mr. Haywood?
I'd like to rebut a couple of points. First, again, by insisting that a personal injury action is necessarily necessitates personal judgment is just incorrect. There's nothing that says that a personal injury action cannot be based in quasi and rem jurisdiction, and that's what we're seeking to do here, and that does not require overturning the case law. I think it's clear that what we have here is this gap in the case law that has to be resolved, and we've got Baker that tells us that although contingent, this insurance policy is nonetheless a piece of property. And so it's not a stretch to simply say the implication there is that it can be determined that the plaintiff has a right to that piece of property. And in emphasizing the nature of a personal injury action has to require personal judgment, you're emphasizing form over substance. Now, discussing very briefly the ship example, which actually is discussed in Mullane here, the language from Mullane says that a state may indulge in the assumption that one who has tangible property in the state has abandoned it, in which case proceedings against it deprive him of nothing. And then further, on page 317, this court has not hesitated to approve or resort to publication as a customary substitute in a class of cases where it is not reasonably possible or practicable to give more adequate warning. Thus, it has been recognized that in the case of persons missing or unknown, employment of an indirect and even a probably futile means of notification is all that the situation permits and creates no constitutional bar to a final decree. The insurance company, which is the party that stands to lose the most here, had notice of this action. This is not where we're sneaking up behind them. They had full notice of this action. The service was adequate, and allowing the insurance company to skate free on this test on this technicality that doesn't even apply would be a windfall to the insurance company. And for that reason, any holding to the contrary would violate public policy, because otherwise you're giving them a windfall. And the situation is essentially no different than a probate case where you've got a defendant that's been served but passed away. The same thing. We're simply asking the insurance company to uphold its obligation and distribute that piece of property that's uniquely situated for our plaintiff. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Haywood. Thank you, Mr. Hanson. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. We're going to go ahead and call the 10 o'clock docket at this point. We have one case on the 10 o'clock docket, Platt against Aspenwood Condominium Association. Counsel, we've read the briefs in this case. We are familiar with the record.